Good evening. Thanks for all coming tonight. I appreciate it. If I do struggle for words once in a while, it's probably because I think it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So I arrived yesterday, but that's okay. Glad to be here. I'll give you a little bit of a rundown about Cybord's history maybe before we go through and do the boring wine tasting side of it, so that perhaps you get a little bit of perspective of what we do, how this all came about, and what we're perhaps trying to achieve as we go forward. You know, everyone's got a wine story, and every winemaker has a different perspective. And I suppose the way I look at what we're trying to achieve here is we're trying to achieve wines with great clarity, purity, and perhaps very good value for money, but they're also kind of true to their form. Cybord was started by Owen Ingalls, who made his money through handbags, all the laptop bags you used to see in airports, and some of the high-end bags through Gucci, etc. While they were never made in Owen's factory in China, they basically used to make the componentry and ship them back to Italy, or he'd make the laptop bags in the early 80s and 90s. He was the first person to have a non-joint venture in China, and I think ended up selling his company. He had something like 15,000 employees. They used to have a whole village that was, you know, made handbags and bags, etc., and he sold that and then moved to Australia to start his own wine business. His family's always been involved in grocery and wine through Hong Kong, etc. He and his wife's from WA, they've moved back started this business. So my previous life worked for Shaw & Smith and was the head winemaker for almost 13 years. And then in 2013, I decided to leave and start my own little business. And in the process of that, I was looking at various options, and one of them was a winery that came up for sale. And part of that was a winery that had been abandoned for a couple of years. I couldn't make the numbers work, so I knew Owen was looking for a winery, and I'd known him because I'd made his wine previously under contract at Shaw & Smith. So we presented the case for him, and he basically said, fantastic, love it. You know, I said, it's going to require a bit of investment. He said, that's fine. I'll only do it if you make my wine. So we kind of had to shuffle a little bit, and I wasn't quite there, but you know, maybe. So here I am today. Since 2014 was the first vintage in March. We walked in, myself, two German backpackers, a winery that had been abandoned for 2 years. Every pump didn't work, every hose leaked, and we basically started. So we only made the reds there that year. All the whites were made off-site under contract, except for a secret Chardonnay project which he gave me. We did 140 ton, and then so sort of fast forward today, we now we do just under 800 ton. We have full-time bottling line, and we've probably got close to on-site probably close to 12 to 15 people working in the winery, and we've probably tripled the winery space. In terms of the winery itself, we've started with a very nice looking winery, but a very impractical one. And we talked about our sustainability credentials and our profile, etc., during the tastings we've been doing today. We've gone from a winery that today, while we're not organic, we are the largest sustainable vineyard in the Adelaide Hills. We have all of our company vineyards have gone through that, which is was done through a thing called Entwine, which is now being taken over by Wine Australia. We have 100 kilowatts worth of solar panels on our roof, so we're basically trying to reduce our consumption. All of our wastewater is actually processed on site. We don't ship it anywhere. We deal with it all on site, which goes into our woodlot and also onto our small vineyard on the winery site. We capture all the water off our roof, which we process and everything else. So everything is kind of a closed loop system in terms of what we do. You know, when we first walked in, we insulated all the tanks. We put a nitrogen generator in, so we push all of our wine with gas. We don't use any water in that regard. So we're trying to look at things about how we can make processes better, but how we use less energy, because everything costs money these days. When we expanded the winery, we completed stage two of the original winery plan, which is another 1,000 square metres under roof. We put a barrel shed in there. We insulated the whole shed to an R5 insulation rating. For those that are in the building industry, kind of know that that's a reasonable insulation level. So, you know, you can feel the temperature difference. So we put in the most efficient cooling system we could, and which was it's an evaporative system, but it operates on a heat exchanger, which is a fairly revolutionary. It's been around for a couple of years now, developed by Sealy. It's able to operate at a higher temperature. It increases the humidity in our cellar while keeping our cellar at somewhere between 16 to 18 degrees. while running a small fan, which is the same as running a light globe. So we just, it's all that kind of stuff in the background that people don't see. It's that kind of attention to detail, that innovation, those things that I'm always looking for, that if we're going to do something, we might as well do it very well, so that one, it lasts, but also perhaps it reduces our footprint in what we do. So since then, we've done all those little bits and pieces, but they don't make the wine. You know, the wine for us is made in the vineyard. So really, all of this stuff that you're kind of seeing has been an evolution since 2014 for me, since we've come on board. Really, I took full control of the wines and the winemaking from July 2014. So really, our first true vintage was 2015. I think since then we've seen a pretty good evolution, which has been highlighted today with some of the tastings that we've done in terms of where we've been. We're an Adelaide Hills brand that really today is trying to produce some exceptional wines at, you know, good prices that show focus and where we need to be. So first wine I think you looked at was 2016 Sauvignon. So that was interesting because I haven't seen this wine for quite a while, to tell you the truth. It's obviously, we've moved on. We're in 2018 at the moment in Australia in terms of the Sauvignon. But it's probably not a bad example to have a look at in terms of Sauvignon Blanc. Can't be unhappy with the fact that this is heading to 3 years old. It is a Sauvignon Blanc, and obviously a lot of people will drink unoaked Sauvignon Blanc at a very early age. Typically within 1 to 2 years, you've drunk this type of style of Sauvignon Blanc. And I think this is probably showing some of the early work that we have been doing and do in the vineyard in terms of what this vineyard is capable of. This comes from our estate vineyard, and it's one I classify as an A-grade vineyard in terms of wine delivery. I used to take from this vineyard before that from the best Sauvignon Blanc, and without a doubt the best Sauvignon Blanc maker in Australia, and that's Shaw & Smith. They have a reputation. You go there, it is everywhere. It's probably one of the most expensive, but widely distributed, and certainly the largest Sauvignon Blanc producer in the country. And they've done that via a reputation of getting the best vineyards all the way through the Adelaide Hills. And I should know, because that's what I used to do. So I can kind of speak with some sort of authority that it's not just me, but it's all this also, you know, the third party people and people that rate the wines and all the rest of it through the country that recognise, you know, Shaw & Smith is the best producer, and as the head winemaker, along with that, this was one of the vineyards that we used to take from. And I say used to because they don't anymore, obviously. 16, not a bad year, good. Probably a slightly warmer year compared to, say, 2015. But I think with these particular wines, we did a little bit more oxidative handling, so we are able to make a little bit more of a robust sort of style, and stainless steel fermented and basically put into bottles. So to me, this particular wine, and particularly with Sauvignon, it's about the vineyard. If you overcrop Sauvignon, you'll get what you deserve. You often get something that's incredibly aromatic. It's pungent, and it can be pungent for the lychee sort of style, the passion fruit, which is often what we get in the Adelaide Hills, right through to the cat's pea and the asparagus, the tinned asparagus, which you'll get from New Zealand. Okay, and that's a very basic flavour spectrum, but that's what you get. But then you get nothing, there's no mid palate, and then you get a burst of acidity. So if you want that style, that's what you'll get. And that's a very easy thing to find. You'll find that at probably, I don't know what it is here, but maybe your 4 pound section. It comes out of something that's normally overcropped, and it's not made like the rest of the wines that you'll actually look for. But you start spending a little bit more, like your 10 pounds, etc., then you will come across some of the higher end Sauvignons that don't actually treat it like it should be. They look for the style in the vineyard, they will not overcrop it, they will actually take care of it in every step of the way. And Sauvignon can actually be a variety that can age, but it can actually drink really well. It can have a mid palate, it can have some complexity, and it can have some layering, and it can age a little bit. It's not as good as Shiraz or Grüner Veltliner or Riesling, but it can age. It just has this really bad perception. The wine writers hate it, the critics hate it, and there's a lot of winemakers that hate it. But I've kind of grown up with Sauvignon, And I think it has a very diverse style. You'll see a fumé possibly tonight, which we do as well, which is an oaked aged, you know, oak fermented. It's made like Chardonnay. And then you'll see an unoaked like it is here. So there is varying things that you can do with it, and it works really well. So, and for a 16, I think that's holding up pretty well in terms of, and so that's perhaps give you an insight into perhaps what we're trying to do, that we're not making wines just to sit there and be discarded, but they will have the potential to age if need be. Has everyone tried that tonight?
Yeah.
Anyone think it was all right?
Yeah.
There's probably lots of Sauvignon, might be lots of Sauvignon Blanc drinkers here that don't like, well, that's some, sorry, there's probably lots of people here that don't like Sauvignon Blanc, but I think it's a variety that can actually be slightly underrated, and perhaps we've been too spoilt with some of the varieties coming out of the New World. So, but a good vineyard is, can do it justice without a doubt. Just like anything, if you overcrop a lemon tree, you'll get crap lemons. And it's the same with peaches and everything else. Put some effort into it, measure it, give the fruit what it needs in terms of vine balance, and it will deliver some pretty pungent and amazing fruit, and then you can make some good wine. So Mapinga Chardonnay, a bit of a perspective in terms of Sidewood. We went from one main vineyard, which is the Sidewood Estate Vineyard, which is just outside of Oakbank. We've got, pity we don't have any, I've got some lovely photos of, it's a, under frost protection. It would get between 5 to 10 frosts a year, lowest being about -2.9, and it's protected by frost protection. So it's a really cold vineyard, and people don't probably think Australia, it's a warm, hot country, so everything that comes out of Australia is warm and hot. The Adelaide Hills is actually classified as a cool climate area, very much like Tasmania, not as cold as Tasmania, but it is. So you would put Adelaide Hills in the same realm as Yarra Valley, Gippsland and Tasmania. So that's kind of where we sit. The Barossa is, so on their northern border is the Barossa Valley, and on our kind of southern border is McLaren Vale, and then on our western border is not quite border, but Langhorne Creek. So we sit in this unique little pocket. We're almost 75 kilometres long and about 30 kilometres wide. But what gives us our cool climate tag is elevation. So Adelaide, if you've ever been there, it's a small little city that has hills surrounding it. And you literally, in 20 minutes, you can drive up to Mount Lofty, which is our highest peak at about 700. And that causes almost like a rain shadow. So not only do you have some of the high, well, the highest rainfall in SA is just in the Mount Lofty ranges, which is where we're based, but also that elevation will give up to 10 degrees in temperature difference between the flats of Adelaide and up to the Adelaide Hills. I always carry a jumper in the back of the ute. I actually live in the foothills in the Adelaide, and every day you don't know what you're going to get, but you've always got a rain jacket and a jumper in your back. It can be 25 and sunshining in Adelaide, and it can be drizzly and 15 all day in the hills. That's just the way it is. And that other elevation gives us that that climate. So as a result, we tend to pick later. I literally finished crushing our last lot of Shiraz last week before we got on the plane here. I'm here for a week and then I'm back there finishing off all that kind of stuff. So we've only just finished, which is in a, this vintage particularly has been short, sharp, but very low, and it's given us a compact vintage. So we would normally be picking perhaps in May still. So we, you know, it's not unusual for us to be doing that. So that is, that means that we are one of the last regions to kind of finish up. So we're cooler than most people. So these wines hopefully show a little bit of that elegance. That's kind of what we're trying to do. Sorry, Mapinga Chardonnay, 16. This is our top Chardonnay. We do a single vineyard, sometimes one called the Owen, but this is the top Chardonnay we see from here. So this all comes out of Dijon clone Chardonnay out of the hills. Cheers. Is that, was that a cheer somewhere?
Yeah.
Chardonnay out of the hills, I tell you, it's as good as anywhere in the world. And I know there's probably a lot of people in here that drink Burgundy, and I've had my fair share, and I continue to try and help the economy in Burgundy where I can. But the hills has, an Australian Chardonnay has come a long way in the last 10 years for those that have been following the evolution. We have gone through an evolution of being big, buttery and sunshine in a glass to perhaps leaning a little bit to the lean side. I'm very much about Chardonnay that shows balance and power within that middle realm section, and it's all about the vineyard in this case. I want something that makes you salivate, but also you can have with food. It doesn't show too much oak. It doesn't show... It's about that kind of journey of having something that flows through. And since we use two Dijon clones in this particular one called 95 and 76, and they have different properties, but they retain beautiful acidity. This would all have been a wild ferment, all French oak. So a whole bunch. So we stick it into a press and we just take out the free run juice and it goes straight to barrel, and then it's wild fermented into barrel. And then it basically will sit between normally about 10 months in barrel, 10 to 12, depending. And then we will bottle it. So it's a very hands-off, again, let the vineyard do the talking. And I'm going to be saying that a lot, and I apologise if I say let the vineyard do the talking, because that's kind of what we're trying to establish, and that's what my philosophy's been compared to perhaps the way some of the wines were made in the earlier days when it was a bit more manipulation. Me, it's about trying to step it back and make sure that we get it right in the vineyard before it comes into the winery. It makes my job and life a bit easier. Bit of a selfish thing, but it's kind of where it's at. So when you have... Tasmania is certainly getting a little bit of press of late, but consistently the Adelaide Hills produces some of the top Chardonnays in the country still. And they are a lot more elegant than people realise. Again, it's not that buttery sunshine in a glass. It does have elegance and power. And when you get your Tana and, you know, some of the top producers all the way through still producing amazing Chardonnays, I think it's it can hold its head up pretty high. So, and this wasn't, 16, while a good year, wasn't an absolute exceptional year. It was a very good year, but it wasn't, like I said, I think 15 was good. I think 18 was an absolute cracker, and they've all had their varying. But if we can do Chardonnay like that in a year, which I think was good but wasn't exceptional, you know, those exceptional years do show really, really strongly. So, and I think we're getting better with Chardonnay.
Do you do most of your quality control in the vineyard?
I think we do quality control wherever we can. Vineyard is the first point of call. Sorry?
Is it hand-picked or
mechanical? Yeah, so this is all hand-picked. So we pick... So Sauvignon's machine-picked by a selective. So we have our own machine. And we'll harvest, depending on how cool the night is and when we start, but we might start, and depending on how big it is, we'll normally start at about 12 or 3 o'clock in the morning and finish up at about 6, and then the winery is 15 minutes away. So we'll pick that, get in, and then we literally are processing it straight away. So that's with the night pick. So, and when the nights are, you know, 2 or 3 degrees, we don't need chilling. So it just ticks a lot of boxes. And a selective is a French machine, which has a berry selective on there. So what it does is, with a lot of machines, they over-row and they have these things called rods, and they beat the vineyard, and the stalks are left and just the berries drop. And with the selective, what it does is it goes over a series of rollers and it basically rolls out all of the other bits, and you're basically left in the bin. It's quite unique. You're just left with berries, whole berries. Yeah. So you lose a little bit more in the vineyard in terms of the leaves and mog and all that sort of stuff, but what you get in is amazingly pure. So from that, we're able to tip that straight away and process it. And even sometimes with our Shiraz, we literally tip the Shiraz into our open fermenters. We don't even run it again through pumps and all that sort of stuff. We don't need to. So that's how clean the pick is. But with the high-end products, we will hand pick still. And that gives us the option to whole bunch press, which is a gentler process. Or use whole bunches in Pinot, or, you know, it gives us a few more options. And with the Chardonnay, we'll often chill that. The process is hand pick in the morning into bins there that are slotted, and then we'll put down to our cool room. So we've got three cool rooms at the winery. We'll chill that down. So they're set at, you know, 2 degrees. We'll chill that over a 48 hour period. Whole bunch that. And then that whole bunching is literally just a gentle squeezing. The juice that comes out will go straight to barrel. And then that barrel is left in the sun for half a day, and then it's stuck in our cool room. And whenever, like I said, three, we've got another cool room set at 13 degrees, and then it's just left there to ferment gently. So that'll ferment up to 2 to 4 weeks, depending. Sometimes 6 weeks. And it's, you know, we get a little bit impatient by the time they're 6 weeks. But They'll just gently tick through, finish, keep tasting them every day. Do I want Malo? Do I not? Sometimes I let them go through a little bit depending on the year, and then we will basically sulfur them, and then we'll stick them in the barrel store, and that's where they stay. Just top them every now and then and sing to them and stuff, and then they're, you know, they're all good. But often, and every time we look at them or we'll taste them at least once or twice a year, get the barrels down, keep tasting them and tasting them, and just sometimes we then barrel select from there. So we'll narrow that selection down even further to make sure that we're getting the best of the best. And that's kind of where that process is there.
Using French
oak. Yeah, so that's an evolution in itself. There was a particular set of French oak that had a little bit of American. Since then, all the American's gone. And we use a selection of 500s, like puncheons, 300s, and then 225s, and that's changed. Because back in the day, every Australian winemaker would have just used 225s, and then everyone would have used 300s for the American oak, etc. And what we're finding is that in certain vineyards, they like the larger format. It retains fruit. So the 500s have a purity of fruit and retain that freshness. And the 225s will impart a greater oak influence. But in certain vineyards, I think, for us anyway, it needs it. So, and then we also do French oak trials and part of that whole trying to keep the innovation alive. For us, we're always trying new barrels, seeing who the new producers are, what they're like, and keeping an eye on the old producers, because French oak producers, as they get bigger or more popular, they tend to stretch their resources, because to do a French oak barrel, it's 3 years minimum normally, or 2 years minimum. So they will sometimes stretch their resources if they become popular, and then that changes their blend, so to speak, and the way things look. And so we need to kind of keep on top of that. So there's a fair bit involved.
Yeah.
Who likes Chardonnay? You can say no. I have no problem. Too much oak, not enough. No, all good. Yeah. Just lovely, good purity for a fruit tree there, isn't it?
A nice acidity.
Good acidity. Yeah. Is anyone a little bit surprised by the Chardonnay or the Sauvignon?
I think the Sauvignon was more restrained than I was expecting. And that's a plus, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because I was expecting something more akin to the New Zealand
style,
but
yeah.
Obviously with the cool climate, I think that's reflected very well in the wine.
Yeah, and again, I talked about that, trying to have some balance, which is really, really important to me. We do tend to have that this year particularly. It was interesting, the Sauvignon I've got in tank at the moment, which is just finishing ferment, or just finished ferment, has probably some of the strongest kiwi fruit and lychee that I've seen. I'm pretty happy with the way they go, but we do tend to get probably a little bit more on the tropical side in the hills. You do tend to get that cat's pea and whatever else if you tend to crop up a bit and then you pick a little bit earlier. And that's basically where that aroma does come from. And there are producers that will look for that. I tend to be a little bit more on the, I don't know, perhaps balanced side of the spectrum.
A bit softer.
A little bit softer, perhaps a bit more drinkability in that regard. I think drinkability in Sauvignon is a really important thing rather than sluggability, you know.
Spitting out ability.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. So 16 Pinot, that's, again, I haven't seen this for a while, so that's interesting. We've been trying the 18s today with some of the single vineyard clones that we've got producing. So Pinot Noir program is interesting for us in that we've really adopted Pinot Noir. And I suppose I'm saying this because we've seen a massive development in terms of how we've evolved as a company and as a vineyard. 16 has come from the Mapinga State Vineyard, and this probably would have had some 777, the early 777 possibly, and maybe the early Abel. We've planted, we now have four clones of Pinot Noir, including in that is the Abel clone, which is the old gumboot clone, which arrived in a gumboot into New Zealand and got through customs with a guy called Malcolm Abel, who took it and planted it out and then became one of the most widely planted Pinot clones in New Zealand, and it came from DRC, so Domaine Romani Conti, which is a very famous vineyard in France, the most expensive wine in the world. So that we have that clone. We have another clone called Oberlin and another clone called 777, and then the old and an older Australian clone called MV6. And from that, we've been able to really diversify and make a wine that has evolved. And so this is the early beginnings of this. And so it's really interesting to see this wine compared to the way the 18s have evolved. And perhaps it's good because it's actually looking very good for an Australian Pinot out of what I would call a relatively new beginning out of the hills. So the hills traditionally doesn't do... It is known as a Pinot, but it's probably more known as Pinot in Australia than it is anywhere else. And if you were to compare Australian Pinot, we have four main areas. We have the Gippsland, which is lower central Victoria. We have the Yarra Valley in Mornington, and then we have Tasmania, and then we have Adelaide Hills. There's five, sorry. So they're the main regions for Pinot in Australia. Everywhere else has... It's too warm. It's not in the right aspect. Doesn't have elevation. And Adelaide Hills, out of all of those, tends to be perhaps one of the producers that will produce a lighter style. Tends to be more fruit-driven traditionally, and perhaps sometimes made a little bit more like a red wine because some of the people that were making it were Barossa winemakers and those sort of things. So they tended to treat it like Shiraz. And Pinot, you can't treat like Shiraz. Pinot, you probably have to treat a little bit more with a delicate hand and treat it a little bit more like Sauvignon. It doesn't like a lot of oxygen from where we are because we don't have, one, the right clones, and two, I think, places like Burgundy and those sort of areas where they're able to take they're a little bit more robust. Here they're more delicate, and that's just what we have to do. We have to make wine according to what we're supplied with. And here this is what we're trying to do. So we pick it a little bit earlier, and we tend to make a more of a delicate style, and that's really seasonal and quite influenced. So it has slightly less oak. We tend to use 10 to 15% new oak. We do a lot more whole bunch experiment than most people realise. So this, from memory, I think had around about probably 25% whole bunch. And whole bunch, I mean literally whole bunches thrown into a fermenter, and then we'll let them ferment naturally. We will then sometimes put whole bunches on the bottom of a fermenter or on top, and then we'll put destemmed grapes in on top on their skins. Other times we'll do 100% whole bunch and let that go, and then we'll put it in the sun, and then they naturally ferment. So what I mean by naturally, I literally leave them and we just watch them. And then every now and then we'll turn them over to freshen up because they get a layer of, if they're really good, they'll get, they won't get too much of an acetic layer, but Pinot does go acetic pretty quickly, and we just turn them over gently until it starts fermenting, and then it generates its own heat, generates its own alcohol and CO2, and then it's protected and it's good to go. But that is that can be a nervous period, and Pinot can turn really quickly. I have seen it turn really quickly. So you can't have anything that's damaged. You can't have any bee-ridden fruit. You've got to really have good vineyards, and that's what we talked about before. Good vineyards make it easier for me. Otherwise, we have to do a lot of work. We're just, turning it over more. And then we may have to overseed it and we have to do other bits. So it's savoury. It's held up quite nicely. It's got lovely acidity. There is still a little bit of fruit there with that strawberry and tertiary flavours coming through. But there's nothing. It's just, and a bit of raspberry, I reckon.
A bit of cherry.
Yeah, definitely. Glazed, that sort of kind of glazed, and cherry. So, I'm pretty happy with that. It's held up very nicely. It's like a child you weren't quite sure of. It was going to go either way. You thought it might end up with tattoos and a bit, in the gutter somewhere, and it's actually turned out okay. So, yes, it's got a decent job. And like I said, we're just seeing the evolution because this was very young in its vineyard age. Red wine is, to me, sight is really important. Vine age is incredibly important, and then the viticulture. And in this case, what we were doing with this particular wine is the start of a journey, and it's, you know, it's varied. Today, in, you know, 2019, we're 3 years on from that. These were grafted vines, so we cut the tops off of some older Sauvignon and Chardonnay vines, and then we put these new clones and we grafted them on. And so by grafting them, we basically gained probably 5 years, well, 10 years really, in terms of vine age. Grafting still takes 3 to 4 years to really kind of grow into the graft and to get itself settled, etc. But once you get past that period, you've immediately gained the vine age of the roots from down below. And that power down there will translate into the top part of it, I suppose. It's just the top tart needs to settle a little bit. And so, like I said, 18 vintage, which is what we just tried just recently, the tasting is really, it's maturing into this amazingly good site, at which we're able to then start to separate out. So this has three different clones in it. We've now got four clones, and we're now finding that we're able to actually produce some single clone wines, which are sort of kind of that next tier above to show you where how that evolution has gone. So it's the start of a journey that we're pretty excited about, and it's been good. It's been good. So it's worked well. And then 15 Mapinga. So this is probably for those that know Australian Shiraz. We're back into the country. This will probably be quite familiar. This wine has won more medals than bloody most major generals in the American Army. It's just phenomenal. It's been a very big success. Yes. Yeah, that's it.
Well, it got 98 points in the
decanter. It did. So, Adelaide Hills Shiraz, if I say Shiraz to people, if I say Australian Shiraz to people, Adelaide Hills is not going to spring to your mind, all right? But it should, and it should going forward, and it will more and more. People say Barossa, you know, that's, I grew up in the Barossa, I can say that. I kind of grew up with a 100-year-old vine, you know, all that sort of stuff, sold to Peter Lehman. Grew up with my hands getting dirty, pruning and pocket money and all that kind of stuff. But for me, the future, certainly a big part of the future going forward will be coming out of the Adelaide Hills and some of those cooler climate regions. And we have the topography, the ancient soils, the sites. We just don't have history and we don't have vine age. So the Adelaide Hills basically was first planted by Brian Crozer. Was planted before then, yes, but they're really the first true viticulture for the modern world was planted about the 80s. Okay, so we don't have, and Shiraz really, major Shiraz plantings occurred in the sort of kind of 90s, 95, 96, 97. So when we talk about Shiraz in the hills, we don't have Barossa history. We don't even have wines, we don't have vines that are 30 years old. But we are now starting to see vines that are 15 to 20. And from that, we're seeing those sites emulate where the really good sites are. Whereas, you know, in France, in the Barossa, you know, they've had hundreds of years to actually find out what works and what doesn't. And they're probably a little bit, there's some greater flexibility in the hills and, well, in Australia, obviously, compared to France, but France is kind of put all their eggs into one basket, and they may need to change that eventually when, you know, if climate change keeps happening. But with Australia, we've been lucky enough to kind of experiment, but that's also led to our ways being a little bit haphazard. But now we're starting to go, do you know what? That site has always worked really well for Shiraz. That site has been crap. Let's rip it out and put something else there. And they're now starting to have that mindset. So, you know, in the last 5 years, we've had the Jimmy Watson Trophy, which is the best one-year-old red in Australia, which is a major, major trophy. It's not too many trophies that I put any acclaim on, but the Jimmy Watson is one of them. We've had Decanter Awards. We've had International London Wine Challenge. We've had wine writer after wine writer. And person, you know, just going, what the hell? What's going on with these Australian Shiraz? And it's the Adelaide Hills that's shining. But it's not getting the press. So I just kind of one of those things that I think it's cool climate. It's elegant. It's often spice, it's often layered. I can make a Barossa-style Shiraz out of the Adelaide Hills, but I can also make an Adelaide Hills wine out of the Adelaide Hills, and that's really, I think, where where the distinction lies, and what we're really starting to see now is that we're seeing elegance, layers, and expression, and perhaps a true style of suddenly emerging, because we have vine age, we have skin thickness, and we're actually getting something at long last.
So, worried about climate
change? Extremely. Mm. Yeah. I've been, like I said, 20 years, and I've only really seen, I watch the weather. The weather is my life. And we monitor everything from groundwater, heat, you name it. So the rapid change that we've seen and the adaptions we've had to make, and this is part and parcel of what we do, as looking forward for how we're going to plant, what we're going to do. We're now looking at everything from rootstocks that are able to cope with a greater salt content to heat stress vines, to how we cope, greater canopy management, all those kind of things. Water management is huge. I've seen, in the last couple of years, we're just talking about EPA, which is Environmental Protection Agency. I'm just getting approval at the moment to receive other people's wastewater into our winery so that we can then use that water to sustain our vineyards and woodlot, because everything's becoming so dry. And it's the variability that is the biggest factor for us. It's, yes, everywhere people sort of think it's getting colder because you have one cold winter, but they don't kind of realise that the surface temperature is actually half a degree warmer. The grounds, the signs, and that kind of half a degree means that we have a greater evaporation. So therefore, the groundwater doesn't stay, or the surface, well, groundwater doesn't stay as long. So then we get the vines drying out quicker, and the soil drying out, and it just has a whole range of impacts going through, right through to fruiting and flowering and all those kind of things. So this year, we had it all thrown at us for 2019. We had a reasonably good and wet profile coming into spring. We had more frost than we've seen for a long time. It reminded me of 2006 in terms of frost. We had hail, massive hail storm, which reminded me of 2003. We had a couple of hail storms. I can't remember that one. We had incredible wind during flowering. So we had hail and then wind. So we had vines stripped, etc. We did have some heat. That didn't affect us so much. It affected perhaps some of the other places like Barossa, etc., because we weren't as far ahead in flowering. And what resulted was crop levels at half. So I had Shiraz bunches that would normally have, 100 to 150 individual berries, would have had about 20. So they're like holding up a stalk, and the stalk weight in a lot of the cases was at least half the weight of the berries. So ridiculous. Crop levels at minimum 50% across the board, and that was pretty well universal across there, just because of the variability in climate, and we couldn't do anything about it. So that's perhaps my biggest worry, is just that adaptation. So we are moving to adapt to that change. It's just how far we have to move, I think. So yes, I'm a bit.
With this particular Shiraz, how long would you be able to keep this
water? This Shiraz will stay a while, I reckon. The innovation, I think, has been screw cap for the Australian market. When Grosset pushed for that in the Clare wines, etc. It's very interesting. I've been lucky enough to try Pusey Vale Rieslings when they experimented in the 50s and 60s. They experimented with the Alumbus Pusey Vale Riesling. They basically experimented with screw cap, but they also experimented with a cork, and then they put a screw cap over the top of it. And they had that, some of them, in their museum wines, and they are some of the most magnificent wines that I've seen in terms of their purity and longevity, etc. But the market didn't accept the screw cap, so they canned it, and then, turn around 30 years, 40 years later, and then they've brought it back in again. Screw cap is that game changer in terms of longevity. Pinots, even the Sauvignons, they would have aged a lot more, and they do age a lot more. I like cork because it's a natural product. My issue with cork is that no one cork is the same. And so if I go and buy a car, and there might be a 5% chance that not all the brakes will work for you. I know it's not the same, but it is, it's consumer. And to me, I would go to a wine tasting and I'd open up 12 wines under cork and I would see 12 different wines. And that's just because I'm a trained, I've got a trained cellar palate, so I know what it should look like. But even having three of those wines were corked, that means that three out of that 12, when a consumer tastes the wine at a restaurant with no, you know, no knowledge and all the rest, they go, yeah, it was all right, but I didn't really like it. I don't think I'll buy that wine again. I've lost that. Do you know, I've lost that consumer. That's the, so this at least gives us consistency, and as a result, as a side benefit, it gives us longevity. The downside is that it can, people sort of think it's foolproof. It's not. A knock on the side can sometimes cause it to, you know, to have some oxygen ingress. Mostly it's pretty good. And it can also take a while for particularly wines and the style that I make, sometimes it can make them need to be in bottle for longer before they're drinking at their peak. They just take a while to get there, if that makes sense. So, yes, freshness.
In a way, they work better for white wines because then you can preserve all the aromatics.
Yes, yeah, for the aromatic wines. So it changes the way... It's also changed the way I make them. So I use less sulfur. I use less additives. I think there's that upside as well, that kind of less is better. We're able to do that. The only thing we need to watch out for is the sulfide component, which is that struck match. I don't mind a bit of that struck match, but I just have to be careful about it particularly during red wine making and those sort of styles. So that kind of, again, attention to detail. But a wine like that, that's looking pretty bright and, you know, drinkable now, but I think that'll have a good life ahead of it, without a doubt. It needs some food, though, I think.
Yeah, it's a massive contrast from the Pinot Noir.
That versus the Pinot, you're just sitting there and you go... They're very different compared to Adelaide Hill, to Barossa.
10 years?
Easily.
Really?
I think that'll be 10 years. That's already 5 years, almost 4 years old now. Yeah, I think that won't have a problem with 10 years.
You're not getting the climate though, are you?
Sorry?
Sitting in the sunshine. No. That also makes a difference.
Yeah.
Enjoyment of the wine.
Yeah. Yeah, I think with a, you know, good fire and a nice cosy night, that's the way to kind of do it.
Say a bit about the geology that you're sitting up there. You've spoken a lot about the altitude and...
So the geology is quite old. We tend to have clays, we tend to have a lot of clay, not so much limestone. So the soils tend to be quite acidic in the hills. We have a sandy loam sitting over normally a clay base with lots of free-draining soils. And we do have some quartz, but a lot of it is actually ironstone, so quite free-draining little red ironstone pebbles that run through, and certain vineyards have a greater percentage of that. And the really good red vineyards tend to have a greater deal of that free-draining soil over the red clay, and that tends to work quite nicely. And again, that something that is north-facing with a particular free-draining slope, and then you go a 500 metres the other way, and then you get something that's completely different and it's not as good. So a vineyard really has to have a good grower and or manager or viticulturalist, and it has to be an A-grade site. That makes a vineyard. It can't just be a good site and someone tries to bastardise it and grow too much and all the rest of it. So we're 100% estate grown except for the Shiraz. And we're working our way towards being 100% estate grown, which is part of the benefit, I think, of what you're seeing here today. So, we're able to kind of pick and choose, manage to the nth degree the process from the viticulture all the way through to our new bottling line. So we're basically just trying to be like those little in-house Burgundy producers or Bordeaux or whatever else. It's about the control. And if you grab the control, then you can control the quality and the message and what you're trying to do. And that's really important because it's a 5%er here and 1% there. And we managed to pick that on the night we wanted to pick it rather than being dictated to by someone else. No, it's ready to go. Let's pick it tomorrow. Oh, okay, and we can do it. And that's a really important thing. It makes a big difference to what you're seeing here today. So very lucky in that regard. Any other questions?
Yeah, when are you going biodynamic?
Well, it's an interesting.
What do you think about biodynamics? It's quite trendy, isn't it?
It's very trendy, a little bit.
Yep,
they are, and it's a little bit like organics and all the rest of it. We've been discussing this question endlessly today. It's like organics. So most people's perceptions of organics, and I've got to be a little bit careful, but most people's perception of organic is that it is everything free. It's just, let's just, you know, go with nature and let it go as it goes. But often that's not the case. So they still use organic pesticides, and they still, you know, that kind of thing about, they're just still, yeah, they're kind of missing the point of the whole thing. It's a monoculture that's done. We talked about sustainability and what we do, and we, you know, with being part of this, we had to jump through a lot of hoops and trying to do those feedback loops, etc. It's so, and biodynamic is not that much different in the fact that you're picking it on fruit days versus not. You're going with the phases of the moon, and those that believe in it have a massive, massive belief. There's no doubt about it. And look, I will concede that tasting wines on different days produces different results for my palate. So I might be doing trade tastings, and I might be doing 5 days in a row or even 2 or 3 days, and I will find that the same wine on different days will look different. And whether that's related to a fruit day, a root day, all that kind of stuff, it may be. And other times I kind of think it looks better on a root day and it shouldn't. So people talk about the purity of fruit and how it's, you know, it becomes a religion. And so if you want to follow that cult, I think, and if I could follow that cult, I probably would like to go there. But the fact and the reality is that I think we produce wines of purity and fruit. We do a lot more than just, I mean, I'd like to be 100% organic. And I think one day we will get there, but I think we'll get there by mechanisation. So Australia's minimum wage at the moment, there's a lot of things that people don't kind of get or understand, but Australia's minimum wage at the moment was $18.93 without taxes. In the vineyard, the minimum wage is like $21 to $22 an hour without taxes. So it ends up being around about $27 to $30 total cost per hour. And we found out today that in Europe, it's somewhere like, you know,
fourpence.
It's not much. Okay, so we are battling already against the odds. That is just the way our government is structured. You know, we don't. So already we're probably double our production costs in the vineyard, which is what you need to run an organic vineyard. So we run sheep through our vineyard, so we do one less pass in terms of tractor passes. We employ organic measures in terms of weeding and those kind of things. But in a really horrendous year like 2011, we'll still run sprays through where we can for botrytis, but we'll also try orange oil and those kind of things. And, you know, we're trying to be sustainable as possible and use less of the things that we need to lose. We're probably about that far away from being organic. But if we certify ourselves to be organic and then we have a really bad year, we want to leave ourselves open. So I suppose we're trying to be a little bit more true to our vineyard than necessarily than not. And we still spray some of those. We use, so every second year at the moment, we've got certain vineyards that, tops of hills particularly, we've been putting down a lot of mulch, so we're using compost. We're using mushroom compost at the moment with chicken manure. We've been doing that for the last couple of years, you know, ripping. We use sea salt sprays. We actually organically mix it up ourselves, so we'll actually get the base sea salt and then ferment it and then spray that as a foliar spray. We do a lot of that kind of stuff, you know, and you add the solar panels and you add this and you add that and you whatever else. I could go out and buy an organic, I can go and buy organic grapes if I want to tomorrow, but then I can bring it in and inorganically process it and use a winery that's, you know, more polluting than anybody else and whatever. Do you think that's helping? We're talking about, you can go and buy a cucumber that doesn't have a plastic wrapping versus one that does. And the one that does will last for 2 to 3 weeks, whereas the one that doesn't, you know, it's a matter of that perception and how that consumer will see that. And that organic and biodynamic doesn't ask all the right questions. It just gives you a feel-good feeling. It's no better in a lot of the cases. So I think what will be better for us going forward, and as you can see by the things that I'm already talking about and what we're passionately trying to do, I'd love to go there, but we need, for us in Australia and for a commercial vineyard, we need to be mechanised. And that's probably the next step. We need to be mechanised by battery or solar or something that can run without a footprint. So we use where we can, sheep and all of those kind of things, all of our labour, you know, all our printing's done by hand, blah, 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 blah. It's that sort of stuff. And do we spray sun systemics in certain years? Of course we do. But we use it to the absolute minimum we can. And we are so close, but we're just not there yet. And we could probably be there if we were able to have either one, drop the minimum wage and go back to half of it at $10 an hour, or we become mechanised, which I think is the way of the future for every vineyard, because then that would reduce that overall cost to be able to then take that next step. And innovation, glycophosphate and blah, 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 and all those kind of things, they're slowly being phased out and people are actually innovating and coming up with new ways. So we're trialling some of those, like using ex-botrytis spores to then stop botrytis because it takes the spore places. We're using, you know, like I said, orange oil, which we were using at one stage, which gives minimal protection for under certain conditions, but it's not a silver bullet. And yeah, so we're slowly but surely we're expanding our repertoire, and then one day I'm sure we'll try with our warmest vineyard, which will be at the winery. That'll be the first vineyard. If we ever do, we'll go organic or maybe biodynamic. But then you've got to pay 10% of your profits from that to an organic certification person every year to then say that you're organic. So, you know, then it raises the cost again. So it's who's benefiting and what, where do you go? There's just so much that consumers don't know about what goes into these little things. So, again, long-winded, I told you it was.